Well, I'm looking at two old Testament passages, one 700 years before Jesus was born in Isaiah 53, and the other one even older, 1,000 years earlier, when David in Psalm 22 says some remarkable things that neither Isaiah nor David could have understood the full implications of it. When I was a little kid, I remember two quotes my mother, my father was a voracious reader, read novels all the time. My mother occasionally would, but she'd read A Tale of Two Cities, which I've never read or seen the film either. But I remember two quotes. It's a far, far better thing I do today than I've ever done before. And it was the best of times. It was the worst of times. God willing, I'll come back to that. I mentioned a few weeks ago on a Wednesday how in the 16th century, Luther, 1570, nailed his 95 theses, his points for discussion, debate, to the door of Wittenberg Cathedral, and nobody ever came to discuss. And it was a very long process, and he was brought to trial a number of times and so on. Then as the Reformation took hold, there were a number of attempts to unite the breakaway group, the Reformers, the Protesters, the Protestants, to unite them with the church in Rome, who labeled them schismatics, because they'd broken away and so on. They all failed, and they all failed because of one word, imputation, which my title this morning is Incredit. Imputation means that the Reformers were saying that my sin is credited to Jesus on the cross, and his righteousness is credited to me. And that was a point that was not to be discussed, because Rome didn't like it. And they still don't like it today. They said that the Reformers basically made it up. And then in 1958, Pope Pius, after a long, long in the job, passed away. A fellow called Roncalli, nice middle-of-the-road guy, came along, Pope John the 23rd, and he said, let's open the windows of the Vatican and let the wind blow through Christendom, and let's unite everybody together. These are not schismatics, they separated brothers, and let's unite everybody under one head, the vicar of Christ in Rome. Again, there were discussions, even in the 90s, there was something called ECT, Evangelicals and Catholics Together, and they tried to discuss and unite, and some felt that they were now united, there were no problems anymore, they'd mended their fences and sorted out all their arguments. But again, there was one word not allowed to be discussed. Rome would not allow it, and that word was imputation. Now, I just want to look at Isaiah 53, because the Reformers didn't make it up. They did not make up imputation. Now, I think it was about maybe 18, 20 years ago, I was invited to one of the local university groups on a Monday night to do any Bible study you like on the Old Testament. And I just thought I'd go through the Messiah, the coming of the Messiah, starting in Genesis 3 and so on. I found it thrilling. I don't know what the students made of it, but I'm not doing that now. I just want to focus on the one passage and the one word, really, the crediting of my sin to Jesus and the crediting of his righteousness to me. Because I do believe if you get that, everything falls into place, the Christian life. So, The Tale of Two Cities, apparently, say, I've read it, I haven't seen the film. I basically got my mother's little quotes, and I looked up on the internet to have a rough idea what it was about. It's about a fellow called Sidney, who was a bad man. Everybody knows he's a bad man, and he knows he's a bad man, apparently. But there's another guy called Charles, and Charles loves Lucy, and Lucy loves Charles, but also Sidney loves Lucy. But apparently, as Charles is about to be executed, Charles and Sidney look quite a bit like each other, so it's possible for Sidney to replace Charles. And he does the far, far better thing he does than he's ever done before, is he says, I'm a bad man, Charles is a good man, I will take his place, and they'll execute me. And therefore, the better man, Charles, can now be with the woman, Lucy, who loves him. It's a great story. Great story, it sounds like. I don't know why I have never seen a film of it. And, you know, Charles Dickens wrote it in 1859. But obviously, Charles Dickens did not realize that this was not a new concept of somebody taking the place, somebody dying in the place of somebody else. Now, Charles Dickens' view of Jesus and Christianity was that Jesus walked around patting people on the head saying, "Well, try harder now to be good tomorrow," that kind of thing. Well, unfortunately, Dickens didn't realize that 2,000 years earlier, Jesus had died on the cross. But earlier than that, much earlier than that, the Lord had promised that this was what was going to happen. Now, again, some of you remember the story of the 300 years before Jesus was born. There was an empire, and Seleucus was the emperor. And if you remember, he was one of these meticulous fellas, so he had a list of crimes on one side of the page, punishment there, so there was we let him off this time. No, that was the crime, that was the punishment. And if you remember then, somebody rushes into him one day and says, "Emperor, we have a man here, this is his crime. What should we do?" And he says, "Well, you've got the ledger, what does it say?" "Well, you know, the punishment is two eyes to be plucked out." "Well, do it then," he says. And they say, but Emperor, you know, come and see the man." Of course, the emperor comes to see the man in the cell, and the man is his son. So he says, "Well, you take one of my eyes and one of his then, because that's still the punishment fits the crime." Now, of course, Jesus comes along. He doesn't do that to us. He doesn't say, "Well, I tell you what, I'll take some of it. Look, you take the rest." He doesn't even say, "I'll take most of it. You take a little bit." He takes every vile drop. And when you read Isaiah 53, you know, I mean, it's astonishing. The detail that Isaiah, again, couldn't have had any real grasp of what he was talking about. And then 1,000 years before that, before Seleucus, even 1,000 years before Seleucus, in the book of Leviticus, we got the two goats or the two lambs on the Day of Atonement. We got one, the priest puts his hands on the goat and it is slaughtered and the blood is put wherever, all these different places. And then the other one, he lays his hands in it and he confesses the sins of the people and he drives it off outside the camp into the wilderness. Oh, so we had the picture there. So there was not a newfangled invention of Wycliffe or Calvin or Luther or Tyndale. It was the plan hatched before the foundation of the world. It wasn't a modern plan. It wasn't even as old as the hills. It was even before there were any hills, before there was anything. It's absolutely tremendous. I remember somebody attending a funeral in West Wales, and a fellow called David Morris was preaching. A lovely Christian lady had passed away, and he began with the great plan of salvation, Jesus on the cross. And then he finished saying, "And that was the plan. And when the Lord, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit had agreed that plan, then they said, let's create the world." And I just remember thinking, that is absolutely mind-blowing. That is tremendous. Now just listen out to some of the words that are in Isaiah 53. And what we're looking for all the time is this notion of imputation, of substitution. Just listen to some of the words. "He took up our pain and bore our suffering. He was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him. And by his wounds, we are healed." Now there's loads more. But surely that's enough, isn't it? How can anybody dispute that? And this was no accident. There was no, the Lord saying, "Oh, dear me, it's all gone pear-shaped. I'll have to come up with something." No, this planned before the world was formed. And of course, the most shocking, perhaps, words in it, "It pleased the Lord to bruise him." It was the Lord's will to bruise him. You know, I remember hearing John Piper on this years ago. You know, this is astonishing, isn't it? The Father, you know, "What do you want, Father?" "I want to bruise, I want to crush my son. I want to do it." It's not, oh, I wish I could stop it and I can't. This is what I'm choosing to do. Why? Oh, I love these people. This is not God the Father trying to salvage some smidgen of positivity from a plan that's gone awry. This was the plan. And there became a time in my life when I saw it. Have you seen it? You know, I can't understand how people can say, I believe it, yeah. Just think, no, I don't think you do. I don't think you've got it. I don't think you've seen it. Every stripe, you know, when they whipped, especially they had whips with bits of bone and metal in it. And of course, they would be like a chainsaw. It wouldn't be like a paper cut. No, this is like a chainsaw cut. It ripped, doesn't it? Every stripe, and it would leave a rip. That's a stripe along the back. Every stripe was for me. Even every bruise, he caused me now to come. How can I refuse? And yet I did refuse, and you probably refused. Perhaps you're still refusing. I don't know. You know, people say, yeah, oh no, I know about Christmas. Yeah, I know about the cross and so on. Yeah. Do you? Now, just a few verses from 1,000 years before Jesus was born. David, Psalm 22. I mean, when you listen to these words, I mean, was crucifixion even thought of as a means of execution? I don't know. But the detail, all who see me, is, you know, think of the cross now, right? This is David writing 1,000 years before Jesus is born. All who see me mock me. Does that ring any bells when you think of Jesus on the cross? Evil men encircle me. He trusts in the Lord, they say. Let the Lord rescue him. Have you heard that before? I'm poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. They divide my garments among them. They've pierced my hands and my feet. Written all those years, 1,000 years before. And are you in there somewhere? And was it, you know, the old hymn, and was it for my sin that Jesus suffered so? You know, I was just reading that every hour in London, there's a sexual assault or a rape. Every hour. Don't even make the news. It's not even news, is it? Every hour in UK, there's an unwanted dog put down. Every hour in UK, more than £10,000 is spent on gambling. Every hour, a teenager under the age of 18 is admitted to hospital for alcohol abuse. Just think, this is going on all the time. And have you seen your own sin? Psalm 28, just read this week. Do not drag me away with the wicked. And I was thinking, well, why not though? On what basis could David say, Lord, don't drag me away with the wicked? Well, why not? Why shouldn't I be dragged away with the wicked? Am I better than them then? Am I significantly better then? Remember driving somewhere late at night, and it was one of these phone-ins on talk radio, I think it was. Lady phone-in, she said, terrible year, terrible time. And there she was, very upset. And then the presenter says, anyway, all the best. I think, yeah, that's all you can do, isn't it? That's all you can. You haven't got anything to help. But Jesus doesn't say, anyway, all the best. Well, there we are, imprisoned in our sins, in the cell. Jesus didn't poke his head around the door and say, anyway, try your best. We've had it. We're doomed, as we are. On the 15th of February, 1921, the first local anaesthetic surgery, an appendix operation, was carried out by Dr. Kane. It wasn't remote. He took his own appendix out. That's how we knew it was working, the local anaesthetic. He was involved, and Jesus is involved. He comes here. That's what Christmas is all about. He comes here. You know, Band-Aid song in the 1984, the Christmas, I think it was, do they know it's Christmas time at all? Well, do we? Do we really know that it's Christmas, that he really came? I read to Psalm 25. Never really noticed it before, to be honest, but the last week, or week before, can't remember. David says, forgive my iniquity, though it is great. No, and I thought, yeah, that's the first thing. He didn't say, forgive my sins, forgive my iniquity, because, you know, it's not that bad, or forgive my iniquity, because I do read the Bible every day. I do come to church. I do try my best, Lord. to be a good man. He says, forgive my iniquity, because it's huge, it's big, it's great. But on the basis of what? I just thought that was interesting, because the basis was, before that he says, for the sake of your name, O Lord, forgive my iniquity, though it is great. He just said, see, and that's got to be the key. That he will forgive me for his own name's sake. Not in any merit of mine. For his sake. For the sake of his name. For the sake of his son. Forgive me for Jesus' sake, we can say, can we? Have you seen that? You know, Romans 8. The sufferings of this present age, you know, and everybody hurts, everybody cries, don't they? The sufferings of this present age are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed. And I thought, well, that's tremendous. And then the next two words, the glory that will be revealed, you know the next two words? In us. You're thinking, what? I end up in credit? Do you remember some years ago, 25 years ago, I think it was OM, they had the two ships, the Doulos. Can't remember the other one. Anyway, doesn't matter. And one of the ships was going down the coast of Africa. And there was a whole group of ladies from Mozambique came on the ship, on the OM ship. OM is a Christian organization, Operation Mobilization. George Verwin was a student, he started it. And all these ladies from Mozambique came on the ship, and they all had HIV. They all had AIDS on the ship. Well, they all had HIV, and they all knew people who had full-blown AIDS, you know. And they were on the ship, and they asked then, the Christians on OM ship, you know, how many of you got HIV? And you know when they said, oh, none of us on the ship, these people from Mozambique just cried. They just wept. They couldn't believe that there would be a group of people, because they hadn't met anybody, any group of people that didn't have HIV. I'm just thinking, you know, what is Jesus offering us? One day glory, no sin. There was a drama a good while ago now. Two Canadian boys, best friends at school, you know, best mates, went to college, whatever, and they went their separate ways. One was still living in Canada. One was in Europe somewhere, I think. And the one in Canada, there was a tragic accident and he died. And his father was a very, very wealthy man, and he owned 10 or 12 of these really famous paintings. And he decided now he would auction them all off in memory of his son. Anyway, the best mate from Europe flies 4,000 miles now to the funeral, attends the funeral of his best school chum. And then a few days later is this auction. And before they have the first painting, the auction is not a Kandinsky or a Pollock or a Hockney or anything like that. It's the only surviving painting that the son did when he was in school. It's not that great, but it was the best he did, you know? And the father had kept it because it meant something to him. And so he says, oh, this is the first one. It's by the auctioneer explains it's by the son. And there's a reserve price of $1,000. Well, everybody looks at it, it's all right, but it doesn't compare with the other son. Nobody's interested except his best mate. He says, I'll have it because he was my mate. I love that and remember him. I'll pay $1,000. And so the auctioneer slams the gavel down. And then he says, oh, hang on. There's something I got to read out. The father has stipulated that whoever has the son has it all. So, you know, all the, you know, ones, the other painter is worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. The best mate, he gets it all for nothing. You know, he's... And... When they said, oh, whoever has the son has it all, I think, you must have read the Bible. Because that's it, isn't it? Because before the world was formed, the father and the son agreed that the son would purchase a people, he'd buy a people for himself, and those people would be recognized as his people because they would turn and trust him. And whoever has the son has it all, has it all. It's a tremendous gospel, isn't it? Are you in it? Are you in it? Or are you just sitting and thinking, yeah, follow that, yeah. Or are you in it? Because you have the Son, and whoever has the Son has life. Amen. We'll sing a song to finish.